Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1 cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
He is away for the rest of his life, Brian Koberger, but that still is not going to stop us from digging and trying to understand how did this all come about? What kind of broken brain did Brian Koberger have? Not to be morbid, not to be gruesome, but to go, if we study this a bit, is there ways of identifying these type of behaviors ahead of time or something else? I don't know. But I think it does raise an important point that we dive into this and take a look at some of the things that led up to the killings with Brian Koberger. Let's start with what was found on his phone. Shirtless selfies, half-naked mirror shots, and the private collection of sexualized images of women. Paints a picture of a man obsessed with his image, but also isolated, detached. Investigators even said it felt Patrick Bateman-like, straight out of American Psycho. Who was saying that for the last 4 months? Hi. But then when you pair this with his interest in killers like Danny Rawling, who also craved a legacy and curated his own mythology, you see the beginnings of a disturbing overlap. Joining me to discuss, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent. Let's start with all of these new findings that have come out from the Cellbrite people. How do you interpret Koberger's, number one, his obsession with photographing himself? Let's start there.
Well, first of all, Tony, I think the reason he studied all of these killers, and there were many, although he emphasized certainly Rollins, I think, did 2 downloads of them, one about a week after, I think it was the 19th, and the other one, I think, the 22nd or so of December. Mm-hmm. It makes so much sense to me. This is a guy who studied other people, who wanted to be good at his trade. I don't think it was so much of a gorish situation or looking at the deeds of others. It was trying to learn from the mistakes they made. How did they get caught? How did they do everything? Look, Rollins used a K-bar knife. Mm-hmm. And look at the knife of choice for him. So yeah. I thought it was more of a educational download of experience of what he wanted to be good at.
I want to ask you this because I found this kind of interesting when we started hearing about, oh, he took these selfies of himself in the mirror, vanity type shots. What's the difference? And I know there's a difference, but what would you say is the difference between Brian Koberger taking vanity shots and, I don't know, every female human being in the United States of certain ages that also takes vanity shots of themselves, probably far more than Brian Koberger ever took. But what is the difference between those two? Because this is not like it's a odd thing to do. I guess it's more odd to think of Brian Koberger doing it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Look, that generation in their 20s, that is what they do. They constantly, I don't care whether they're watching TV, whether they're eating, whether they're at the beach, they are doing selfies nonstop. It's the weirdest thing, but it's definitely that generation. Mm-hmm. And so from that standpoint, it's sort of expected. I think because of the situation that Brian Koberger is in, now we're looking at these selfies and they just seem so creepy. Mm-hmm. I don't know another word, like him in the mirror. I mean, obviously, listen, when you drop 100 plus pounds, And I know that was earlier on, but you're really working on your physique. You're running just over 6 minute miles. Mm-hmm. You're, you know, doing kickboxing and all the other efforts he made. It seems to me he was probably just admiring how far he had come. But you combine that with what he was getting ready to do, and it does look just like he really was proud of himself and had made a killing machine, sort of, and was admiring it in the mirror.
What made me wonder a little bit about this was the one vanity shot that we all heard about early on, the one that we saw, the mirror selfie, the one that I said right away, that looks like Patrick Bateman from American Psycho. And now they're going back going, oh, he was mirroring Patrick Bateman from American Psycho. Oh, yeah. And Psycho too, with just being in a shower scene. You have that, and the timing of it is the most disturbing, because we know what he had just done hours before. He had also just been on the phone with mom and dad, or mainly mom, talking about God knows what. And then he takes the selfie and then goes and starts driving back to the scene on the phone with mom. I'm wondering about the other selfies and the timing of them. And I'm wondering what else he was up to in the moments prior to taking those selfies. Does that make you wonder a little bit?
Yeah, it does make me wonder, was he out prowling? They show that any connection between the times he did the drive-bys and the surveillance and so forth? Is there any timing matchup with those selfies? Also, I bet it was really a treasure trove to see what all he erased, you know, purchasing that software and really wiping so clean that even the FBI couldn't find so much afterwards, or Cellebrite. I wish we could see what all he got rid of, because I believe he got rid of the most incriminating information. What we're seeing is what he didn't think would get him in trouble.
Yeah. And that's what I wonder about, specifically that if we had, you know, the vehicle data on where he was traveling, what he was doing, not that it's extremely matters so much anymore, but I do wonder if there had been any other crimes committed, or just him breaking into homes that nobody knew about, because there was a lot of suspicion about that and moving things around, if that was kind of a ritualistic thing. I mean, the guy does kind of seem to have a ritualistic way of doing everything in his life. I would guess that maybe taking those selfies were part of the ritual. Do the thing, go take your little trophy of how strong you are after you did this and how good you think you look, and then, you know, rinse and repeat. I really wonder about that.
Yeah, I think that now we know, obviously, that selfie is so telling, the one in the shower. That's why it makes sense to jump to those possible conclusions, right? Because he did that. So if he did that in that instance, was he doing it in other instances, maybe with other sorts of crime, even voyeurism?
Yeah.
You know, things along that line. What was he doing to commemorate something that could remind him and trigger him, like a trophy, a picture he took as a trophy? So I think that makes a lot of sense that he certainly could have been doing that.
What does it tell you about the preserved women's images that are also on his phone? You know, he didn't share them. We don't even know exactly what they were, as far as I understand yet. I'm assuming they were just screenshots taken off the internet. I don't know that they were secretly taken. That would make it even creepier, but I doubt that's how it went. Is there any element to Brian Koberger that's normal? I mean, I don't store random women's images on my phone, but I know guys of that age, you know, who would. You know, that's just how some guys are. Does that make it really weird? Or is it like, well, that's just, you know, I guess somewhat normal for a 20-some-year-old man that they have pictures of scantily clad women on their phone?
Well, my understanding is some of those pictures involve women scantily clad that are sleeping, that are drunk, that are not moving, that are...
That's a little weird. Know, yeah, that's not normal.
Vulnerable.
Yeah.
And like you said, really, how many people keep strangers' pictures? Mm-hmm. I think some men do, probably more actual nudes.
Yeah.
But my understanding and the reason I think it's particularly weird is because they were unconscious.
Yeah.
And that's always been the connect with him, right? And it's so Bundy-like. Mm-hmm. It's so Rawlings-like, because they, you know, they were definitely into total control. And really Dahmer, while we're at it.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally controlling a human sexually and in every way, really. That's what they did too. So I just, can you imagine, Tony, if law enforcement wouldn't have been so amazing as to catch him within 6 weeks or so, mm-hmm. about 6 weeks, can you imagine what he could have become? Because he did a decent job committing the crime.
Yeah.
If it weren't for one stupid move, and that was that sheep.
What's always so interesting about these characters is, I mean, when they have this MO of believing they have strength, believing they have control, because they basically have a passed out, drunk, or dead victim next to them. I mean, that's just a sign of utter weakness. If the only way you're going to have any sort of interaction with a member of the opposite sex or whoever you're attracted to is when they're drunk or passed out or dead, that's not strength. That's as weak as it gets. That's the only way that you're feeling anything here is when they're helpless and they have zero agency of their own. I always find that interesting. I mean, that's more psychological on the end of this, but it's fascinating how they twist that in their mind as a believed sense of control.
Well, that's because you're so normal, Tony, that you see it as such an oxymoron. But these people see it as total dominance.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to kill somebody. I don't even know what's comparable other than, you know, like an athletic world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you win your biggest championship, you can win. Mm-hmm. Or something like that, that adrenaline rush.
Sure.
Where you feel like you've conquered something you never thought you could. And that's what I think that feeling has to be. And again, this is from everything we've read, everything I've studied, everything we've learned, interviews and so on. I mean, that's what it's like. It's like this euphoric state of conquering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess we'll never be able to understand it because we're normal.
I'm good with that. I'm good with never quite having a brain that clicks that way. Rawling, who we've talked about a bit here, and obviously he's looked up. He left little things out there in the ether before he was executed. Audio tapes, journals to preserve his quote-unquote legend. Do you see Koberger's digital archiving as a more modern version of that impulse? And I'm wondering, do you think we're going to see more archiving of Koberger's legend as he may view it as he sits and rots in prison for the rest of his life?
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, just the fact, which I'll still never understand, I don't mean to beat a dead horse,
mm-hmm.
but that the prosecution did not make him talk about his crimes, mm-hmm. and reveal where those bloody clothes were, reveal where that knife is, all of that. And who knows what more might be out there. I could really see him using this someday as, you know, calling cards, or I guess calling card isn't the right word, but some sort of legacy trophy that's left behind that someday he'll reveal.
Yeah. I mean, the possibilities are, I guess, you know, endless as to whatever he's going to come up with. He's got all the time in the world to think about it now. Then we get to what investigators found in Koberger's digital footprint on Christmas Day of 2022. While most people were with family, he was downloading the entire case file of Danny Rawling, the Gainesville Ripper. Alongside that, he was searching for violent pornography. As you were talking about earlier, those words like forced sleeping, voyeur, those sort of things, they certainly overlap with Rawling, who preyed on sleeping college students. I mean, it really is striking. Do you think Koberger knew more about Rawling than before Christmas Day? Because that seems to be the time that he starts popping up in his search history. But again, he did wipe a lot of it. Why do you think suddenly Christmas Day, after all this, he started digging into that specific case? Was it because the feds were closing in on him and he wanted to see how Rawling got away with it for as long as he did and just decided, gee, maybe now might be a time to start looking up that end of the plan?
Well, I saw back, I believe, Tony, on the 19th, he did a search also, if I recall correctly. And it makes me wonder how many other searches were done, but that he erased, you know, that we don't have this full trail. But even if you have two, and as you mentioned, downloading that whole file, I think he was, you know, comparing himself, right? Comparing himself. How did he do? How did he do things? And I think he was preparing for more. We know he was purchasing another knife. He wasn't purchasing another knife, I don't think, to just sit on the mantle. I think he had other plans.
With characters like Rawling and some of the others that Koberger was studying, quote unquote, they would stage a lot of the crimes at the end, set them up in specific ways. We know, obviously, this was a horrific, horrific scene by the time he got out of there. But somehow, amazingly, he, as far as we can tell, he did not have a trail of blood that followed him out of that place, and whatever he had on him, he obviously got rid of without anybody catching him. Are you surprised that this wasn't more of a stage scene, or did it just get too messy, you think, for Koberger? And I'm wondering if staging it was going to be part of it, but maybe that plan got kicked to the curb when he realized he had four people that he was dealing with.
Yeah, I really think he just ran out of time, and you know, I was just reading one of Dylan Mortensen's report. I still have hundreds of pages to go through, Tony.
Yeah, there's a lot.
I just got hundreds and hundreds. I try to do a report a day. But basically, she specifically said he looked at her. Like he knew she was there. At least that's how she interpreted it. And I mean, I think he was worried about getting caught. I really do. I think he wanted to make sure he made an exit. So I think the time that he would have liked to have spent possibly staging, he had to spend cleaning and getting out of there with that, with leaving less of the trail. I also wonder this, Tony, and I don't know if you've thought about this, but I truly believe his intention was to violate Maddie, minimally. Maddie. And my whole thing is, obviously, he was very good about not leaving a trail, right? A forensic trail. I just wonder what his plan was for regarding that. You know, was he going to do something like what BTK did, where he would just masturbate beside the body, not interact with it, I think, because of evidence again. So I always wondered if that was going to be his intention. And I still think that that was his probable intention, so as not to leave something behind that could connect him.
The cleaning aspect of this, right? We've seen different takes on this, but it does appear there was some element of cleanup that he attempted to do. What can you say about that from what you've gleaned off of these new findings?
Well, Tony, I tell you, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the his cell videos. I posted two of them. But on one, he's meticulously cleaning his Crocs. You know, he's wiping them down at the side. And you could tell he is so OCD, which we already knew. We knew that from the, you know, the trash scenes, from wearing gloves, from all he was doing, obviously, also to conceal his DNA. Being sloughed off somewhere. But this guy is a clean OCD sort. And so it doesn't surprise me at all, especially with his background in criminology, that he knew he was going to have to clean meticulously after these crimes.
Yeah. And how, what do we know about what he did to clean after those crimes at the house? I mean, did was there cleanup involved? I mean, obviously he had to get himself cleaned up. But is there any signs that we know of that he tried to do anything? I mean, this was quite a mess that was created there. So any sort of, you know, viable cleanup or any sort of cleanup that would make a really sort of impact was out of the question. But did he do anything?
Well, you know, I don't think he was concerned at all about their blood spatter or, you know, their the mutilation of them. He was just concerned about leaving anything behind. Yeah. Lockhart's theory, you know, you leave behind when you come in, no matter where you go, a part of you. And I think he did a great job making sure that he didn't leave a part of him, except for, as we've talked about, the sheath. And so I you know, I'm just convinced he had multi-layers on and that he disrobed quite easily and put that into some sort of plastic bag. I'm still bothered by this tool that he supposedly left with. I saw another description of it, which described a diamond shaped as cylinder with a diamond shape at the bottom. I know some people, and you even brought up, could it have been the sheath sharpener?
Yeah.
I just don't think it was that, because I don't, the K-bar knife would be so sharp.
Yeah.
But I wondered if she actually saw the K-bar, but drunk at a distance, quickly moving, if the knife would appear to be a cylinder, and then that handle, the way he held it, maybe appeared to be in that odd shape. I don't know, but I'm still digging on that. And hopefully we'll get some of these forensic reports, Tony.
What do you
I want to see these forensic reports.
Yeah. And what are, I want to talk, I'm going to go to the forensic stuff in just a second, but it's fog of war at that moment in time. And when anyone is trying to recall what was going on at that moment, our minds are not playback recorders. It's having to reconstruct everything every time we see it. So it's easy for our brains to try and say, well, I think I saw this. So then it's trying to make sense of what we're seeing. So whatever she saw, whatever she's trying to recount seeing, that's going to be a difficult one, I think, no matter what. And it may not really be, it may be exactly what you said. It may just be the K-bar itself. But in that moment of shock, you're thinking, what is this? Why? You're not even thinking, why is there someone with a knife running through my house? So that's going to be, I think, probably a hard one to crack. If there even is anything to crack, or just a memory that, you know, is blurry, you know, to a certain extent. But yeah, these forensic reports, what are you looking forward to seeing most as they come out?
Well, I know it might sound morbid, but I really want to understand the blood spatter aspects of all of this. I want to understand, because it still seems confusing, how far out did Zanna come? You know, now I'm reading reports where Dylan thought Kaylee was running up and down the stairs. You know, she seems very convinced. And then later she says, where's the effect of, but now I'm not sure if it could have been Zanna from what I know. In other words, you know, she later is listening and talking and gleaning other information. Remember, she initially told investigators that was Kaylee in Zanna's room.
Yeah.
Because she thought Kaylee had gone down there. So there's all this sense of absolute confusion initially as to what she really sees and hears. And a lot of it, she's just hearing.
Yeah.
She doesn't peek out the door to see who's running up and down those stairs. But I believe that a crime scene reconstructionist has put together precisely what they believe happened in terms of Kaylee. Did she come up and down the stairs? I don't know if they're going to be able to 100% tell that. I just want to see all the reconstructionist stuff and all the forensics.
Do you think this thing, as Koberger was moving about doing what he did, do you think it's just one unexpected thing after another for him, where he was like, shit, now this person's, it's not comical in any way, shape or form what he did, but just him going in thinking, I'm going to nail this. I'm going to go and I'm going to go kill her, whatever the hell he thought in his mind. And then suddenly, you know, this pops out of nowhere. That person pops out of nowhere. All these unexpecteds pop out and once again, screw up what he had in his mind in this very black and white way of looking at life of here's what's going to happen. Here's how it's going to go. And that's what it's going to be. And then suddenly it's just chaos throughout the whole thing. I'm wondering how much of this was a complete surprise to Koberger. And then did he walk out of there at the end of the day, murdering four people, almost himself in shock that he took out four people when maybe his thought was he was going to go after one. And I also wonder too, was murder the original intent on this, or was it going to be an essay and then disappearing out the back door.
So I've never been one that's believed ever that this was, and I know people have said this, I'm not sure where it comes from, that he was just, you know, a PhD student and he was going to see if he could get away with the crime. This, I don't know how strong I can state that. Mm-hmm. I think that is absolute malarkey. The people that buzz with that. This was so vicious and so deep-seated and so evil. This was no accident. I think he 100% meant to go in there and murder. I think he enjoyed it. I think he reveled in it. I can almost see him like gutturally banging his chest afterwards. That's how I see it. This was absolute euphoric for him. That's how what I think.
What I'm wondering about that though is he didn't expect. I don't know that he expected all these people to be there. I mean, let me ask you. And with that being the fact, I mean, in my brain, when I'm, it almost is like a cinematic scene. I keep picturing the shocked Brian look, the big eyes, like, oh shit. Like, and then having to quickly move. But the amount of angst and hate and everything that he felt towards women like this, attractive, successful, they got their life going on. They have friends. They're everyone that he can't have by his own actions. And then you also have, Zana's boyfriend as well, Ethan, who was there. I'm wondering how much of this murder and how crazily this thing went was more spur of the moment. Maybe one was a target. Maybe one was the intent to kill. But I'm wondering how much of this got fueled by his rage, by suddenly there's other people here interrupting what he thought was going to be, an essay and maybe his first sexual experience. And I put that in air quotes. That's not a sexual experience, obviously, but I'm guessing he was probably a virgin. And I'm guessing that he, in his sick, horrible way, was going to think he was going to get some sort of enjoyment out of that control of an essay. And I'm just wondering how much of it was just, he literally, the rage, cap just popped and he decided, I'm just going to take out all these people who represent everything that I can't have and can't be. And that's what made this thing the horrific, horrific scene that it was.
Well, when you think this is a logical guy from the standpoint of he did surveillance, mm-hmm. he planned,
yeah.
I think he had it all together. So Tony, he looks out there at his site he's going to hit and yeah. he sees all these cars.
Yeah.
So first of all, he has to understand that there are people connected with those cars. So I don't think he thought just one person was in there. And I think he was prepared that he might have to kill more.
Yeah.
He also intersected. He knew about that DoorDash. Mm-hmm. They passed each other. So he knew about the DoorDash. He knew what lights were on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he knew, and I think it was exciting to him that he could have trouble, that it wasn't going to go perfectly. I think when he attacked Maddie in that bed, I don't think he had any idea that Kaylee was going to be in there.
Yeah.
And I do think that enraged him. And then, he was ready to wage war against anybody else who got in the way of him getting away.
And
that's how I think.
That's my point on the rage, where it's like just one, because he spent so much time seemingly scoping this out and all and in his mind, he's so smart. He's going to do this. It's going to be smooth sailing. I don't know that he would have gone in had he known the high probability of getting caught with that many people in there. That's what gets me about it, is if he wanted to be this sleuthy killer that was going to go and get away with things, he did a horrible job at it. These other killers that he studied, they had their targets. They went in, they went out, they got away with it. This was such, if he spent a minute or two outside of his brain and in the rest of the world looking things beyond his blinders and seeing those other cars there and realizing there's probably other people in that house, I wonder if he would have gone in, or if he was just so, tonight's the night I'm doing this. I don't care if anybody's there. I'm going to take control and I'm going to do this. And then that rage overrode anything else in him that would have said, maybe you want to wait till the odds of you getting caught go down dramatically.
Yeah, I agree with you that definitely the rage and the emotional side of it seemed to take over, because it wouldn't logically make sense to go into that house. But look at the, you know, one he studied possibly the most is Ted Bundy.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was like the most,
yeah,
in terms of how he operated, likely Ted Bundy from a psychological standpoint. And so if you look at that, he went into the Sigma Chi or the Omega Chi. Mm-hmm. No, Chi Omega, sorry.
Yeah.
Getting my houses mixed up. The Chi Omega house with all those girls in there.
Yeah.
And without any fear. And, you know, he studied that.
That's
he
true.
He knows all about that. And I think, you know, he was willing to go from, instead of starting out as a fledgling guy, he was went for broke. That's mm-hmm. for sure.
Let's talk about some of the earlier red flags that were going on in the world of Brian Koberger. One of them I want to talk about that really got to me was the professor that was speaking candidly to other professors. And I'm just paraphrasing here. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but it was something to the effect of, if we give this guy a doctorate, we're going to hear about him essaying people and just basically being a menace to society. He saw it early on. I feel, I don't know. When I read it on the air today, I said, you know, if I met Koberger early on, I probably would have said the same thing. And people would have been like, oh, you're being too harsh. I'm wondering if you know what that, you know, what that would have, what your take is on that, what that was like when that took place, what the others, I wonder what they thought of someone making that bold of a statement about someone who had not committed any crimes as up to that point that we know of. I mean, those are pretty harsh things to say, that you think this person is capable of essaying people, and the other horrible things that were said about Koberger all turned out to be accurate, but quite bold statements.
Statements, but in hindsight, Tony.
Yeah.
You know, that's what kills me when people, you know, all of a sudden come back and say, see, I could tell.
Yeah.
You know, my hat goes off to Catherine Ransland.
Yeah.
At least she was totally honest and said, yeah, oh my gosh, I taught him in four classes and I was his counselor and I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I think she was speaking really honestly. I think it's easy for people now to come back and say, oh, yeah, boy, I could tell you that was a serial killer in the making after what's happened. But, you know, I just think most people don't even have the bandwidth in their brain to think of people who act creepy or weird ever having this capability. It is so, so very rare. Mm. So I guess I would say, anybody can say anything in hindsight.
Well, this wasn't said in hindsight. This was written. This is part of all those documents that have come out. This was a statement that was made prior to the murders. It was, Koberger is smart enough that in 4 years, we will have to give him a PhD. Mark my word, I work with predators. If we give him a PhD, that's the guy that in many years, when he is a professor, we will hear about harassing, stalking, and SAing. Like, that's a
pretty... Apology. What was the date of that? What was the date of his statement?
I don't have the date.
I don't have
the date in front of me, but it was early on. It was when they were starting to consider, like, maybe this guy shouldn't be in this program.
Apologies. I thought you were referring to something different.
No. Yeah, I don't have the date in front of me on it, but it was prior to the murders taking place. So, yeah, I mean, armchair quarterbacking it later certainly is easy to do, but it seems like others certainly got the vibe out of him and certainly expressed it in a way, shape, or form. But again, what, you can't do anything other than somebody's going, I got, you know, spidey sense for serial killers and essayers. But if they haven't done anything yet, you can't do anything about it. That's the scary thing about Koberger. This person called it, but I mean, you could probably call a lot of people that actually never end up acting out.
Well, I tell you, I want to take a class by him.
Yeah. No, I would say
seems like he's very intuitive.
Yeah.
Anybody who pointed that out, because, you know, when I watched early on, remember when they would release the different car stops?
Mm-hmm.
We saw the Indiana car stops, two of them, and then we saw the one, at least one of them, that came out long ago, not the most recent one, and, you know, really tried to evaluate him in there. And you could make a lot of conclusions that he was awkward, that he was very in control, that he was disrespectful of his father, basically, you know, shutting his father up, that with the woman, he just was fighting the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, she'd say X, he'd say Y, and they'd go back and forth. It just seemed to me that he was not respectful of her. So there were a lot of conclusions you could make just about him generally.
Yeah.
But like you said, to say, call somebody out as a future essayer, that's really insightful. And I would love to hear him go deeper into that, like the specifics.
I would too.
What did Koberger say?
Did
Koberger do?
I'd love to see more of the email. We just got the excerpt in there in one of those reports, and that's what we have. Another thing that Koberger, obviously, we knew about this. He was trying to get into the police program. He wasn't always looking outward at serial killers. He was trying to move inward into the system itself. Months before the murders, he applied to be a research assistant with the Pullman Police. Early on, we're like, okay, well, he's in the criminal justice system. This isn't in the program, not a crazy idea that he's going to want to get into that program. Sure. Do you think part of Koberger's original bigger plan, and I guess this would also go back to how big of a plan was he planning? Was he planning on who he was going to murder, when he was going to murder, when he bought the knife all those months earlier, and what was in his mindset when he applied to this program with the Pullman Police? Do you think he was trying to get in there to try and steer the direction of any investigation that might come about of his future actions? Do you think he was thinking that far ahead?
Oh, I think he was thinking further ahead, but not in that slant.
No.
I think he was thinking about, how can I get information on girls? Mm. How can I pose as a police officer or be a police officer and more easily be able to attack girls? How can I have all this information? I'll be able to know where units are, other units are, what's happening. I mean, talk about, I'll compare this to a case that you're very close to, the Devil's Den case.
Yeah.
That guy, I look at that guy and I think that guy planned this for years, getting his education in elementary education, you know, teaching fifth grade and below only. Right. Yeah. That's what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
He planned to put himself. We talked about foxes earlier, the fox into the hen house. He planted himself there and was willing to spend years getting the proper education to plant himself there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think the same with Brian Koberger. He was ready and prepared to be an officer to facilitate his ill deeds. That's how I look at it.
And that's, I mean, that you had to wonder about that a little bit. Is do they have the patience to do that, to go into something years in advance and the ultimate goal is to go and commit these murders? I wonder about that. Or, I mean, it is the fox hiding in the hen house. Or does the fox get into the hen house and somehow discover, oh, I have a likeness to some of these really horrible things that, you know, we know are horrible, that no one else in this world would approve of other than very monstrous people. Maybe I am a monster. That's what I wonder about with some of these folks. Do they just become comfortable with being monsters? And then after a while they strike, because it's hard to think that someone goes into this 4 or 5 years early and the ultimate goal is to go murder a bunch of people. I wonder if it was starting out in a more pure intent, maybe confused intent because they didn't know who they were, what they were really into, or are they literally setting out going 5 years down the road after I get this at my education, after I get into this setting, whether it be a school setting like Andrew McGann or Koberger here in the education area of in law enforcement or trying to get into law enforcement, if the opinion changes or the desires change midway through?
Tony, I'm convinced these people are absolute monsters.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And then they get the education to make it easier on them.
Yeah.
I don't think it's something that sort of develops. I think people who can do monstrous act, that it's so deep,
mm-hmm.
and it's who they are from very early. So I think McGann, to be able to do that. I mean, he was asking grade schoolers, you know, to marry him, yeah. or I wish I could marry you. I mean, this is a guy that was his goal, I think.
Yeah.
And I find it very analogous
mm-hmm.
to Brian Koberger. When you look at his education, a lot of people want to say, well, he got the education, and as a part of that, he committed these horrible crimes. No, he wanted to commit these horrible crimes and got the education to make him better at it.
We've also learned about the phone calls that Koberger was making to his mom, the very long calls, all, you know, right in the morning. And I know people have been going, well, there's the time difference. Okay, there's the time difference. It was still more than 3 hours of phone calls, you know, right after murders were committed. It did make it a little stranger to think that it's a 6 a.m. phone call in Pennsylvania. But it wasn't, you know, when we look at the time differences, it was for Koberger. But what do you make of these phone calls and these conversations that he had with mom? In no way, shape, or form do I think he was telling mom, hey, I just killed all these people. But what the heck do you think was going on in those conversations?
I think two things. First of all, when he's going back, you know, to the 9:30, I think it was, he returns right mm-hmm. in that time frame, and he calls. I think she is his safe place. She's his Linus blanket.
Mm-hmm.
He finds comfort and strength through that relationship with her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was that call. Because I don't think he knew what he was going to confront.
Mm-hmm.
I think he wanted and expected there to be police crawling and everything. I think he had hoped nobody was there and he'd see a knife sheath on the corner. But that didn't work out for him.
Yeah.
But the other call, you know, and I know you have kids. I have kids that just graduated from college a couple of years ago, these exact same age of these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they call you when things happen
yeah.
all the time.
Sure.
And just to let you know, hey, I'm doing great.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a good day for me, you know, as they grow and you're going to see it a lot more because I know your children aren't in college. So we get these phone calls sort of out of the blue, and that's how I picture this.
Mm-hmm.
I picture this call of him being happier than he's ever been, him just sunny side up.
Mm-hmm.
And wanting to share that with his mom. That's how I picture it. That call just being such a good relation of that.
Interesting thing to look at the other selfie on the phone and phone calls to mom. That would be another piece uh-huh. that would tell us more of this pattern if there was anything else going on. Where was he before he took the selfies? And then was there a call to mom? Were you surprised at all that we haven't heard a ton about we've heard about mom conversations, but not a lot with dad. Dad also was not at the sentencing of Brian Koberger, but dad, of course, was the one who went all the way out there to drive across the country with him to take him back to Pennsylvania right before or right yeah. around Thanksgiving time for what exactly was going on with that relationship in any of these new documents?
Well, there's a couple of things. I think truly his relationship with his father was complicated. Remember, his father was the one that turned him in
yeah.
for stealing his sister's cell phone.
Sure.
That's a big thing for a parent to do.
Oh, yeah.
And think, you combine that with that bizarre scene when they're driving back and he's, I think, grabbed his leg or his hand and basically was shushing him.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that the power dynamic in that relationship is really askew. Mm-hmm. I think you combine that with probably the unusual, perhaps, relationship he had with his mom. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't say unusual, but let's just say closeness. Yeah. That maybe, you know, as you said, his dad wasn't even at his sentencing, for mm-hmm. heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
So when you look at all of that, I just think that that was a hugely strained relationship and maybe not even really much of a relationship at all.
Yeah, I mean, the dad, I mean, obviously there's signs that they cared for him. They tried to help him. He was the one that was out there to the neighbors saying, hey, you know, my son's a bit off, however he said it. Like, could you be his friend? I'm sure that wasn't said, hey, he's off, go be his buddy. But, you know, whatever he said to try and, you know, sanitize it. I was surprised that dad wasn't there, considering how he had, you know, continued to stand by his son. Even after the phone incident with his sister years ago, he was still going out and helping him out. But there he wasn't at all. I wonder if the dad at some point, and this is just pure speculation and I can't speak for him, if he just had to say, I'm done. I can't for myself anymore do this.
Yeah, the straw that broke the camel's back were four murders.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Finally. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that would break almost any parent's back mm-hmm. To a degree. So that's how I see it. I see it as he was done.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting conversation as always. And there's obviously still more things dripping out of the case against Brian Koberger. And we'll continue to break him down as more of it comes about. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent. As always, thank you so much for your insight.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.